Welcome to Global Minnesota Podcasts, connecting, informing, and engaging Minnesotans with the world and exploring important international issues. For a complete list of programs and to join us, visit globalminnesota.org.
Thank you very much. It's no small honor when a great public servant like the former Secretary of State, Mark Ritchie, introduces you like that. So thank you, Mark. And I also want to say thanks to Global Minnesota, to all of you for putting it together and making it possible for me to come home. I have two sons that live in Edina, one at Edina High School, one at Southview Middle School, Magnus and Dane. And so every opportunity I get to come home and see them is a real gift. And I also want to thank my friends at the Cybersecurity Summit, which is based here in the Twin Cities. Every October, more than 1,000 cybersecurity professionals, lawyers interested in issues related to cybersecurity and privacy, chief risk officers from big companies, federal officials, state and local officials, from more than 30 states and more than 10 countries actually come together here in the Twin Cities. So this year, that's again in October, and it speaks volumes to our region and our state's commitment to public-private partnerships. That's particularly in the high-tech space. And I also want to thank the people at the University of Minnesota through the Technological Leadership Institute. I get the great honor of being a senior fellow affiliated with the Technological Leadership Institute at University of Minnesota and get to work with some really outstanding students that are interested in developing certifications in science and security technologies with a master's program. And it does, like I said, that I have been all over the country and at 43 now, I've kind of been a lot of places all over the world. And I'm really lucky to be from Minnesota because we do have a commitment to inclusion, to public service, and frankly, to crossing the public and private sector divide. I started my career at a company, used to be called Norwest, now it's called Wells Fargo. Some of you probably used to bank there, maybe some of you still do. And despite that, they ran off to California. But there's a guy named Jim Campbell, who was the president of Wells Fargo, Minnesota, and he was part of an organization when I was just a very little baby banker right out of McAllister College. And he was part of a thing called the Itasca Group, which was a group of senior executives of Minnesota-based international corporations that were doing things to benefit their local economy and the local, just the public good at large. And so I'm always proud to have had my start here in Minnesota, and I love coming home. So thank you very much to all of you for having me. Before I get going, I have to give you two disclaimers. My first disclaimer is that none of what I say is a reflection on any of my past or current affiliations with any organization, company, school, or the United States federal government. These are my own thoughts on a few different issues and should be attributed that way, not as any organization's representations. I went to law school at the University of Minnesota, so you can blame them for that. The second disclaimer is that this title of this talk that I was asking you, Internationally Hacked, Worldwide Weapons of War. Lordy, this is not going to be a how-to class. For those of you who thought it was, sorry to disappoint. That said, we are going to have an important conversation, and I hope it is a conversation. I really see this as I'm going to deliver some remarks, some of my impressions, again, my own. And undoubtedly, we're going to need to touch upon three key areas, one of which will be geopolitics, the second of which will be technology, and thirdly, public policy, and by which I mean even individual liberty, because there are broader concepts as we think about human endeavor in any domain. And cyber, or the cyber domain, which so many people call the cyber in Washington, D.C. these days, is something that we actually can never allow to be have all those decisions made on public policy by some restricted, faceless bunch of people whom we call the cyber, or the cyber experts. This is where we interact, this is where we conduct commerce. That bank I just told you about, Norwest, became Wells Fargo, became actually a global power, and I think one of the strongest stocks in financial services, largely because they embrace the concept of being a clicks and mortar based business, in addition to being a bricks and mortar based business. And you know, aside from Wells Fargo, you can look at US Bank now, you can look at, if you're a veteran in the services, USAA. There are apps on your phone that they can track where you are in real time and what transactions you've made and where you withdrew your money. They can gyroscopically take my data. If I don't trust, if it's lucky I trust them, But if I didn't, they could be taking that data and selling it to anybody for any purpose. So we are going to need to have that conversation, and I think it is actually kind of incumbent upon all of us as citizens to get more educated on these issues. And I've spent the last about 5 years with this cybersecurity summit group here in the Twin Cities trying to communicate that CEOs, C-level executives, and board members also have a responsibility to get more educated on these issues and not leave it up to the IT department or the lawyers that write big, long end-user license agreements how cyber policy works. Part of this conversation, I'll probably mention some challenges that sound a little scary. I may say some things that maybe some of you will perceive as pessimistic. I hope you don't read it that way. My perspective is coming from a place of faith, my faith, that our American way of life is worth fighting for. That's far better than any of the other options currently on the table that I've seen. I'm a fan. And also, I have a very bullish optimism about what we can accomplish if we can come together for a whole-of-nation effort. Another buzzword in Washington, D.C. of late is whole of government. Oh, we need a whole of government effort. And that's great. A whole of government effort and an interagency effort is wonderful. But we live in a world today where 80-some percent of critical infrastructure is owned and operated by private sector entities. Our adversaries in this domain don't have that challenge. So we have to come together as a whole of nation effort. And it absolutely requires an engaged citizenry to kind of compel that and understand that there are risks if we don't. Just know that I'm coming from a place of optimism and a hopefully constructive consideration. On geopolitics, before we get into the cyber aspect of this, I got a little news flash. The world is changing. So I think we could argue that the world was largely unipolar on 9/11 and probably for about a decade after. 2001 to 2010, we as the United States were the predominant force and the ability to project force and the leader in technology. And I think that we can, at least here's what I'm told by the 10,000 pound brains that work at the Pentagon and the various DC think tanks. And I'm talking about people, not computers, the 10,000 pound brains. But they tell me that we're now engaged in a thing called the great powers competition, right? And I need that because I used to be in the Marines, I need it in simpler terms. Right? And what is this great power competition? At the level of national unity, by which I mean a common governance structure and a united effort and ability to project force and leverage the powers of the state in national interest, I think we kind of deal with three main actors. The first being us, and you think of us as America at the inner ring, kind of our Five Eyes partners. Those are the English-speaking nations that we share intelligence with, UK, Australia, Canada, New Zealand. And then beyond that, kind of a third ring of NATO and our other regional alliances in the Pacific and elsewhere as one principal component of a great power union. The next would be China unto themselves. And I think their interests tend to be less about disrupting our interest in the world and more about ownership of data and expansion of their own influence. And you may have heard of a thing called One Belt, One Road Initiative. It doesn't actually mean that they just want to build one road. It means that they want to have a unified Chinese-based, Beijing-based economy and world order that benefits them, which is fine. I mean, we want the same thing, I think, here in America. And then the third main actor, I think, is Russia as a state and a dictatorial regime under Putin that, after the last 20 years of a perceived national embarrassment, declining economic influence, declining technological influence, either wants to reestablish their own regional hegemony in places like Crimea, Ukraine, former eastern satellite states of the bloc, Or maybe if they can't pull that off, they'd like to knock us and the Western European states down a peg or two. And so the best soundbite I heard on this great powers competition was, yes, it's a great powers competition. There's essentially three great powers. The Chinese want to own us and the Russians want to destroy us. And that's an easy way for me to think about this. On China, I think China is arguably the far more important, strategically, of a foreign policy relationship that this generation must get right. But it is slower moving, and it is based on things like economic power, regional influence, and access to trade and minerals. The Russian component, although perhaps not as strategically impactful from a generational consideration, I think we see them moving faster. And what I hear from the people in the Beltway is it's a closer threat. We see them interfering in elections. We see malign foreign interference. We see them taking actions with hybrid warfare in Ukraine. We see them repeating those same types of campaigns and activities below the threshold of what we would think of as warfare, but above the threshold of what we would consider peacetime. But we see those in areas like Transnistria, even on the edges of the former Baltic states. I guess what I'm saying is, yes, great power competition. Think Russia, long and slow and really important. China, long, slow, really important. And Russia, nearer term and more disruptive and perhaps more aggressive. And I might even argue in some cases perhaps more reckless in terms of what they're doing in the cyber domain and what you read about. Whichever kind of perspective you're looking at and getting your information from, you're probably reading that Russian malign foreign influence and leveraging cyber campaigns they are actively working against us every day. And by us, I mean not just our government, not just our agencies, but our companies, and frankly working to cause discord and chaos amongst us, no matter what our political affiliation is. They perceive that they are winning if we are in a state of discord and disunity. So on the lesser orbit, certainly not non-lethal or to be ignored, not even in the cyber domain. That group ISIS has lost their geographic territory in Syria and the Levant, but they were not just restricted to Syria. There's an expansion of Islamic radical terrorism in places in Africa. Any time that they gather a foothold long enough to start developing capabilities, rest assured that they are downloading information on cheap, effective weaponry or cheap, effective techniques that they could use to disrupt American life and promote their sick worldview. North Korea, again, many of you are aware that they have been developing missile technology. There's an effort to monitor and verify their denuclearization. In cyberspace, they've done some kind of interesting stuff, or at least it's alleged by others that they've done some interesting stuff. They attacked Sony, a private corporation, after Sony made a movie called The Interview. So I guess potentially at least, I didn't read the paperwork and the ones and zeros, but the former director of the FBI attributed potentially to North Korea. But because a company made a movie about a country that had a strange hermit-like dictator, a country with a strange hermit-like dictator launched cyber attacks against that company. So, so don't make bad comedies about dictators is one way to look at that. The other way to look at it is kind of what I'm talking about, although they are not a great power, we need to think about what it means to have free speech and how far we push that. I am an unavowed advocate for free speech. I'm an unavowed advocate for our way of life and our freedoms. And I do think that we do need to, I'll talk a little bit more about this, but we do need to come together and be better defended because knowing that there are perhaps some hermit-like dictators who might not like the things that we do. There may be ideological groups, there may be hacktivists who do not like the way that we live or the way that we do things and govern ourselves. And we need to be prepared for that. And that's just moving with clear-eyed being smart, I think. If you lived in a neighborhood where people were stealing a lot of cars, you'd probably start locking your car doors. So there you have it. That's the great powers issues in foreign policy. And I think if I would ask you to think about the next phase, as I talk about the technology aspects, I don't think we need to be afraid of the Chinese threat as though they're the expert burglars and thieves. If it looks that way because of recent data theft or recent breaches or recent intellectual property theft from the commercial sector or hacking of law firms for data, because we can't consider people expert thieves if we're not locking our doors and windows and they're walking in, right? We need to take some defensive actions and then we can start pointing fingers. I think we have a role in doing a better job there. I also don't know that we need to be afraid of the Russians as though they're expert propaganda geniuses, right? As Americans, we kind of live in our own self-chosen information bubbles. We choose that we will read our sources from this set of news sources. We allow ourselves to get our news feeds now through social media platforms that use an algorithm that self-reinforces and shows us our chosen political views. Even if that's not our chosen political views, we've chosen to engage using social media platforms that use the algorithm to feed us the same string of thought that we've been clicking on. So I think we need to improve critical thinking just at the local and national level as Americans. We need to become better and more open about looking at multiple news sources. We need to think through what we're reading. What was the source that reported to what we're reading? I find it interesting when they look at studies of the Russian population versus the US population, they are considerably more dubious about information they read. They do not believe that because a thing says news, you know, channel 8 or whatever, that it must be true. And I suppose probably 75 years of living under a dictatorship that uses disinformation on some population will make you a little more jaded. Perhaps there's some sort of happy medium where we can start teaching our children and practicing ourselves kind of better, more robust information discipline and applying our own judgment to the things that we choose to believe. I think the other aspect about the Russians that comes to my mind is I think we're seeing an assault on the notion of truth-seeking professions as noble pursuits. And again, this is only my own opinion, but I see a macro trend of attacks on scientists, attacks on technologists, attacks on the nobility of the practice of law as a mechanism to pursue truth and justice. And then also, I think most predominantly, we're seeing attacks on journalism as a means also of seeking truth or balancing that information. So I just see two trends where we've got some work to do on ourselves, right? Understand, seek first to understand, turn the mirror on ourselves. And I think there's a lot of things we can do to start making it better rapidly. And that's along that line. So back to technology. I think we've come a long way since 9/11. Right after 9/11, people probably remember the 9/11 Commission. Not a lot of mentions of cybersecurity or cyber domain warfare or cyber vulnerabilities in the 9/11 Commission. There was a lot of talk of concepts like asymmetric warfare, a couple of people doing a thing that's disruptive to a whole country. There were conversations about concepts like the former director of the National Counterterrorism Center, Mike Leiter, used to call it micro actors with macro impact, right? But he was largely talking about kind of kinetic campaigns, people with box cutters jumping into airplanes. I think in the cyber domain, a thing that we should be considering is the cost of these resources is going down. The interest in procuring them is going up. So that impact of micro actors with macro impact through this kind of vector on our society is heightened. So we owe it to ourselves to kind of ask our public leadership and our private sector leadership to start addressing this together. There's a few things happening. This isn't slow. I heard people describe this as a tectonic shift. I'm not sure it's a tectonic shift because tectonic plates move very slowly under the crust of the earth and cause very slow, massive disruptions. I think this is a light speed shift. It's like the flux capacitor and Back to the Future. It's very high power and things. We don't know what's going to happen next, but we're seeing not just exponentially increasing Moore's law processing power of the computing components. We're now seeing an exponential expansion in the number of endpoints on the internet or the cyber domain. And I had to get that explained to me once. An endpoint is anything that connects to the internet that has some computing power in it. So you know what that means as an endpoint now? Your coffee maker that has the fixed password that was put into it by the hardware manufacturer somewhere in a foreign country that might be an adversary, that might have a fixed hard token password that will never be changed. What's another endpoint? the dishwashing machine that's been connected at the FBI headquarters. That the person that bought the dishwashing machine was unaware was connected to the Internet of Things. What else is connected to the Internet? The garage door opener that I didn't buy at Sears, and I had to actually go hunt and I had to go look in the back to find me a garage door opener that did not connect to the smart home. Right? But the other one that they were trying to sell me was an endpoint with some computing power, and was somebody could figure out what was going on. Not that I'm personally worried about somebody opening and closing my garage door, but the exponential rise in the Internet of Things also demands an exponential rise in the ability of the telecommunications infrastructure, which carries their data. So some of you probably have heard of 5G. Raise your hand if you've never heard of 5G. Oh, good. Okay, that's good. I'm glad there's quite a few. That's okay. So 5G is the next generation of telecommunications infrastructure that will empower things like the Internet of Things to work and call home and manage these massive data streams out on the edge of telecom networks. There's a big debate right now about the risk of having a supply chain in one country. So for instance, a company called Huawei. And again, these are my own kind of personal observations. I'm not saying anything corporately or on behalf of a government, but you can see that that the U.S. administration has now taken a position advocating European countries not to buy Huawei infrastructure because it's likely a Chinese state-owned enterprise. And if they own all of the infrastructure upon which the data moves, in essence, they own all of that data. Here in the U.S., back to the mirror we need to put on ourselves. Rural telecommunications companies are also saying, but we've already bought this infrastructure, we need to buy it because it's cheaper and it works, right? So this is kind of one of those conversations that we need to have. I won't pretend I have the exact answer, but we're all willing to pay for car insurance, which costs a little more than driving around without it, because if there's an accident, there's coverage. I think some of us are willing to pay more for a house that's in a better, less crime-ridden neighborhood. So we're willing to pay a premium for security. Some of us are willing to pay a premium for privacy in where the location of our house is, right? And so I think maybe that's the way we need to think about this. Are we willing to pay a premium for our national privacy or our national security when we think about where that infrastructure is coming from, where it's manufactured, which kind of speaks to another point on this, the hardware and the software and cybersecurity risks are now one and the same. It would be impossible not to think about where these things are manufactured down to the chip level and the component level, and to look at that entire supply chain and who owns those companies, right? So we've got to get smart about how we're looking at global supply chain issues, both for federal acquisitions, which you're gonna have to lean on Congress and ask the people in the White House, the executive agencies to think through, but then also in the private sector, US companies also need to think about that, and chief risk officers need to think about that. Investors and shareholders need to think about that as well, because you cannot separate cybersecurity and supply chain security anymore. So that's the proliferation of endpoints. We're seeing a proliferation in the number of attacks, the types of attacks, cyber ransom, people locking down data, demanding payment in cryptocurrency by US companies so that they can use the data. You never hear about this, it happens. The fact is, kind of crime does pay in the cyber domain. So now transnational organized crime organizations are participating in cybercrime because they're less likely to get apprehended and go to jail, and it actually costs them less, and they have the manpower to do it. So if you were a transnational organized criminal organization with US-based resources, it actually pays more money and higher margin for you to invest in cyber theft and cybercrime, as opposed to kind of old-fashioned crime. The other issue I see is, again, increasing availability of these tools. A proliferation of what's called the dark web, the onion router, and deniable browsing makes it so some of these bad actors can get together and they can create marketplaces to trade in a number of vulnerabilities that can then be used against us. And they don't necessarily know who they're transferring these vulnerabilities to. And so we have a proliferating black and gray market in cyber exploits and cyber threats. Now I think there is probably a ripening period where we can take action, despite kind of this light speed convergence. I think everybody here heard of Office of Personnel Management had millions of US employees' records stolen. Anybody who applied for a security clearance over a set of dates had their records shipped off to likely a foreign country. We talked a little bit about Sony being attacked for making a bad comedy film. Less funny, more on the scary front. Did everybody remember or hear of Stuxnet? Right? And what was the impact of Stuxnet? So Stuxnet, there's systems called SCADA systems that govern the software that runs factories, large-scale industrial components. And so what you saw with Stuxnet is this was a cyber attack. We don't know who made it, but it was a cyber attack that then got targeted on Iranian uranium. Can you say that three times? So Iran's nuclear enrichment facilities, and caused their cycles to spin so quickly that it broke the centrifuges and disrupted their ability to refine uranium and pursue nuclear weapons. Maybe that's a good thing for the world, but I think the scary thing is that we saw a cyber attack that had real world kinetic impact, right? And I think that's one of those things we need to start thinking about also, and I know smart people are thinking about it, is when you think about state projection of force through the cyber domain, it's also hard to think about, it's different than say in the Marine Corps firing a rifle or calling for an airstrike on a specific geographic grid point at a specific time, right? Because that ordnance falls, it explodes, we have a pretty good idea of what the battle damage assessment will be, right? And so you can forecast who will be hurt at what time or what effects you will have. I think it's very important that, and this is an international issue, thinking about in the cyber domain as these exploits are made that can have kinetic impact or real world impact through the cyber domain. What does that mean for the ability or the responsibility of that power that launches that attack to think about what the second and third order effects are, right? How do we know that Stuxnet stops at those centrifuges and doesn't move forward to other SCADA systems and infect them? And what is the responsibility of whatever the state is that develops that attack to ensure that they have measures in place to restrict its ensuing impact? If a foreign power, so if one country were to attack another country's power grid in one city, would they not have a responsibility to ensure that that attack was not impacting an orphanage or a Red Cross facility or innocent human lives? So these are things that, you know, I mean, I do know the International Committee of the Red Cross is looking at this. They're considering these impacts, but we can't sit tight and wait for the cyber people to tell us what the ethics of conflict are in the cyber domain. Some other technologies that can contribute also to this kind of light speed convergence. It's like a tectonic shift, but super fast. The rise of artificial intelligence, machine learning, and increasingly large data sets. So when we talk about artificial intelligence and machine learning, what actually makes that artificial intelligence smart is the size and quality of the data set. Right? So if we look on kind of this state-on-state effort to steal massive sets of data, why would you be doing that? Because you want to train your artificial intelligence on real-world data, not on synthetic data. Right? So then issues start to arise as we think about artificial intelligence, machine learning, the ethics of the algorithms and the models that are being built from the ground up, the security of those models as they're being built from the ground up. We need to think about the nexus now of biotechnology in the cyber domain. Synthetic biology, CRISPR technology, gene editing, right? We need to think upstream if there are mechanisms for stopping the distribution of plans for really bad viruses or really bad epidemic level infections that could be kind of gene edited in somebody's lab. And I don't just mean because somebody is, what scares me most is not a nation state actor, because I think that's pretty reckless and we probably won't see that. Maybe even less so terrorists who don't have long enough in one particular spot to build their lab and grow these things. But just like, oh, oops, I didn't mean to, right? So how do we think about what happens with the ones and zeros that contribute to the production of synthetic biological organisms and gene editing? And that becomes a cyber issue. Another one contributing real time right now, many of you have heard about the quantum computing race. Some of you have heard about it in reference to encryption and secrecy. I'm going to argue that there's an intermediate step. We need to also think about the supercomputing race. We need to think about the technologies that bridge the gap between where we are now to quantum, right? So there's a number of technologies. There's supercooling, superconducting computers that greatly enhance processing power, but aren't yet kind of a full quantum leap. That was an awful 1990s show, but I watched every single episode, Quantum Leap. I don't know if anybody else did. Great show. But yes, we also have to think about augmented reality, virtual reality. We need to think about advanced materials, 3D printing, advanced manufacturing. Those are endpoints, right? We need to think about again the communications advancements that will be happening on the backbone of 5G as that network and as that infrastructure expands. And we don't have a lot of time, I think, is one of the other issues I'm trying to hammer home with, if you take anything away. So broader concepts, we kind of went through a lot of the really bad stuff. Now I'm going to talk about some really, really bad stuff. The Department of Homeland Security has identified 17 different areas of what they call critical infrastructure. The threats to that critical infrastructure tend to kind of come from a few different varieties. They come from nation states. They come from terrorists. It can come from hacktivist groups. It can come from transnational organized crime. I think you can assess that there's probably some risk to some of this from kind of commercial espionage or what you might call B2B violence. You know, one company spying on another company, one company, you know, trying to disrupt another company's ability to deliver a product on time, kind of corporate espionage, corporate sabotage. But of those, the exploits that can create real threats to critical infrastructure that could be as disruptive as what we've been talking about before, like a Stuxnet, would actually need to be financed, developed, and held by a nation state. So, you know, I've heard estimates of beyond 80% of those types of exploits as of today would need to be nation state sponsored and nation state delivered. And then you want to think about another kind of overwhelming number. Of those 17 critical infrastructure areas, I think the Department of Homeland Security estimates something like over 80% of those are owned or operated by private sector entities, not by the US federal government. Our enemies or our adversaries or even our friends don't always have that same need for a public-private alliance in this space. And I might also throw out the thought before you ask questions and we have a conversation that, yes, there are 17 critical infrastructure areas, but maybe they're not all co-equal. I would argue that if the energy and power critical infrastructure segment goes down, the other 16 are going to have a pretty bad day. So in sum, that's pretty scary. There was a big geopolitical shift. And then you'd ask, but who's paying attention? Anybody even notice this? And on Capitol Hill this year, for the first time ever, in what is called the Worldwide Threat Assessment of the United States Intelligence Community, that is delivered to the members of the United States Congress on behalf of the senior official of the US intelligence community, they did not name a country, they named cyber threats. The Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, began his remarks with the number one subject being cyber threats. And so yes, people are paying attention. And it's great to have understanding, but action is the next step. And I think, you know, kind of the other aspect of this, I think sometimes you think about back to my 9/11 analogy. So maybe we got ourselves ready to defend ourselves in 2010 as of today. But with this light speed tectonic convergence that's happening so quickly, we probably have to be ready for 2030 next year. Right? And we have hockey. We're in Minnesota. I remember as a little kid, somebody once told me you don't skate to the man, you skate to where the puck is going. Right? And so that's what we need to do collectively, is get moving to where the puck is going, not where the puck is right now. And yeah, that can all sound pretty scary, but I do hope you all agree with me that history has shown that when America wakes up, there's nothing that we cannot do. I mean, this country pulled itself out of the Depression. This country ran up production and a national call to service and won World War II on two fronts at the same time. I was raised by grandparents here in Minnesota, one of whom was a Depression survivor and volunteered to serve in the United States Army Air Force as a 30-something-year-old man. And my grandmother reminded me regularly that, you know, she always thought it was kind of funny in the 80s that there was this big hype that it was like a foregone conclusion, America would win the war. And she reminded me all the time, there was never a sure thing. That's why they did tire drives. And that's why they brought, you know, they rationed nylons. So Americans really can rally and get amazing, amazing things done at scale, at industrial scale and rapidly. When the need was created for transatlantic shipping for the war effort, America's production created the ability to go from natural resources at the front end of a plant to producing a sea-ready Liberty ship within a number of quantifiable hours. Right? There's literally nothing we cannot achieve if we bring it together. And we do have to accept that we now live in an increasingly high-threat environment. We need to accept that reality and now take some steps to mitigate and reduce our collective vulnerabilities. We need to increase our collective resilience, so when these breaches happen, the holes close faster, right? And I think kind of my next several thoughts on this are, some people have said we need to develop more offensive weapons faster. You know, that's a dangerous thing in the cyber domain, more so even than in the traditional realm of warfare, for the second and third order effects I was talking about. Another aspect of that is the expense in developing offensive resources is very high, and they're single use. Because once it has been deployed, you cannot use that same technology again. You just ran an enormous government program. So it's not like the Manhattan Project. It's like you need multiple Manhattan Projects all the time. So I think you could probably ask PJ Fleck down the street off of university, or you could ask Mike Zimmer over at, where are they, Winter Park now? I don't even know where do the Vikings practice now? Eden Prairie still? Yeah. Okay, good. You could ask him. You could ask Tony Jennison of my beloved McAllister Fighting Scots, but I think they would all tell you that defense wins games. Offense is important, but defense wins games. And when we talk about these cyber vulnerabilities, we really have to ramp up our efforts. And that's got to be our first investment, is cyber defense and integrated cyber defense that crosses these domain divides and improves our ability to address these threats. So here's a couple thoughts on positive directions, things that I have observed already moving in the cyber defense lane. Thought one, I think that we are definitely kind of, I don't know how to explain this, we're at a pivotal moment where I'm seeing a lot of activity where public-private partnerships mean something more than a buzzword. We're seeing a lot of effort with investment from the private sector, what we call IRAD, Independent Research and Development. We are seeing more than just conferences, but I'm observing what are called CRADAs, Cooperative Research and Development Agreements, between federal government agencies and private sector companies. So I think what we're seeing is kind of an understanding is growing between the private sector, government agencies, and academia. And that's important. And so that's a very positive thing, and I think we will continue to see more of it. So what I think the next phase of that is that it expands from federal and private sector to federal, state, local, tribal, higher education, and private sector. It also expands from solely US-based to more Five Eyes and kind of closer NATO partner engagement between private sectors. My second one is, actually I'll say it three times, hardening, hardening, hardening. Hardening these targets, prioritizing what are the strategic value areas that require the highest levels of investment. right? And one of the benefits of that is that that covers every, even though 80% of this might be nation state, the really, really scary stuff, hardening these targets covers all hazards, all threats. Hardening these targets, hardening these networks, making them more resilient, making them faster to patch, also makes them more resilient and ready in, for natural disasters. So it's kind of a win-win, and we're seeing a lot of that. We're seeing investment in security. We're making the supply chains more secure. At the federal level, an entity called the National Counterintelligence and Security Center stood up a thing called the Insider Threat Task Force, which is sharing information across the divide. We're also seeing things, lists that might include manufacturers of components that may not be as trusted as others. These are valuable tools because oftentimes in the past, the federal government has had information that has not made readily available to the private sector. So that's a vast improvement. I think another thing we're seeing a trend, simplification of an inherently complex, very, very difficult job. If you are a security op, they call it a SOC, a security operations center. This is where the chief information security officer, or CISO, and their team frequently works. That's an incredibly complex job. They frequently have 20 to 25 different systems monitoring their hundreds of different cyber, but call it IT infrastructure assets, and it's sounding 100 different alarms at them all day, and they have to figure out which of the 100 alarms is actually a real issue that must be mitigated. Simultaneously, they have to be running patches and software updates in real time on all of those systems. It's a very complex job, and it's not easy. The industry needs to invest, and I think we are seeing this. There's an increased industry investment in simplifying that for the operators of the Information Security Operations Center. We're seeing best practices that have been developed from business intelligence and intelligence decision making, big data decision making, and automating processes so that it makes their job simpler. And the fact is, if we don't invest in that on our side, the attackers are winning every day that we're not investing. So this is not an expense, it's an investment in the security of our future and our way of life. I think the other really positive thing is we're seeing a development of connective platforms in cybersecurity. We saw this, and I'm going to nerd out here for a second, but we saw this on data storage, platforms for data storage, integrated data storage, open models so that multiple companies can participate in the same data storage solution. We're seeing it now in the cloud, cloud integration across brands, so a true platform, so that the owner of the platform can make money in a capitalist system, but so can the other participants in the platform. And I think that is the future of cybersecurity, those that race to the platform model and make it easier and simpler for the actual security operations professionals are the ones that are going to be helping our national security the most as well. I see a lot of cause for hope. In kind of America as a whole, and frankly, kind of, I don't know what the right term is, but Western society, our closest allies in the Western democracies, becoming more awake and alert to what comes at us as individuals through the internet, right? The guy who used to be the director, is the director of the National Counterintelligence and Security Center, his name's Bill Evanina. He's a former FBI agent, and I just love the way he expressed this. He said, if there was an Olympics of clicking, spear phishing, and phishing email links, America has been the gold medalist for many years. And I'm gonna argue it's time for us to just retire from that game, right? But I see a lot of room for improvement because I think the last few years people kind of woke up and said, hey, this is real. You know, it's not just the Nigerian print scam email that I need to be aware of, you know? I need to make some investment in my own education and my own critical thinking, and frankly also not opening attachments from unknown sources. I think with that, I'll open it up to questions. I talked longer than I expected, which is not new for me. Yeah.
When we were all worried about nuclear war, one of the overriding, I'll say, strategies was the idea of mutually assured destruction. You send a missile at me, you're dead too. I understand your reason and agree with your reason for defense, but is there that same idea in the cyber warfare space? I read an article recently, one of the papers, about how we have planted, we being, I guess, the United States, somebody, malware in Russian power grid systems. Is that like a little tip of the finger of this concept of mutually assured destruction? Or is that not the way it's being thought?
So yes, yeah, so if I'm hearing your question, I don't know about the article you mentioned. I didn't read it, but if you're asking about my thoughts on mutually assured destruction as it pertains to cyber warfare, is it a fair analogy for nuclear warfare? I'm going to argue no, and the rationale being, again, single use on these weapons of cyber warfare. Once they're out, the research community, it doesn't have to be a nation state, can rapidly deconstruct and see what it was. And rebuild them, and then all the defenses can immediately be made, right? It's like when your body gets a cold, it identifies that virus, and now you won't get that cold again, is maybe a way to think about that. And then the other reason is that, you know, I think people fall into this, and it's all of us, fall into a trap of thinking that a cyber attack requires a cyber response. And if it causes a little discomfort to think about that, it probably should, right? If somebody disrupts a power facility or breaks all of the target checkout counters, which apparently just happened.
Yeah.
I don't know if they've made any attribution on who did it, but apparently all of them went, maybe it was just a glitch. Maybe it was that 2000 bug. It was just coming in late. Right? But if we determined that it was, you know, the Venezuelans that shut down Target for a day and boy, we're mad. Why do we have to respond with a cyber response? Don't we have other tools in the National Power Toolkit? If it's not Venezuela, but it's a group of organized criminals, what am I going to, must we hack back at the Hacktivist Collective or Anonymous? Or can we send the FBI to their house to arrest them and try them and put them in jail? Right? So I mean, I'm a little passionate about this because I feel like we all need to unlock our minds from the notion that because somebody does something in cyberspace, it must be responded to in cyberspace. And I actually think that as America and as like kind of the leading, I still believe that we are and will continue to be and can be the leading power on rule of law and the laws of armed conflict, right? And proportionality and these principles that have been longstanding since the Geneva Convention. We really need to be the leaders on this, that a cyber attack does not necessitate a cyber response. We have other tools in our kit that we know how to use. And we should make sure that every one of those is on the table. And I think that is how you deter the cyber attack, if people are aware that their repercussions may not be in kind. Yeah.
I have a few they might do.
There was in the New York Times on Sunday an article about our cell phones and what's happening with companies through Bluetooth. You may or may not have read that. But it was a terrifying thing because through your cell phone, a lot of companies who could be government, could be anything, know exactly where you are. They know exactly when you stop. They know if you pause to look at a product. They know what product to send you a coupon for. And it's now this is supposedly through Bluetooth. But it makes you wonder, as consumers, do we have to be that careful with our electronics and our cell phones, or how can we protect ourselves? I mean, I know, I definitely am glad that there are people like you and people in our federal government that are working on cybersecurity, but what about personal security? That was really an eye-opener, that article.
Yeah, again, I don't know the exact article you're reading, and I apologize, I didn't read all the newspapers before I came in this morning, but what I will say is yes, I mean, that is part of my point, and what has been my pitch to CEOs and boards of directors, is you can't simply rely on the U.S. government to protect you as a U.S. company. You need to become an educated consumer, right? And yes, it's probably worth it. You know, I know this doesn't require a PhD in computer science to learn best practices for, you know, individual internet use. But at the individual level, I do not believe that these nation state threats are targeting us. beyond trying to use algorithms to feed us information and garbage that they want us to believe is true and get us all very angry and tweet wars with our friends. I think it's a very valid point, and I guess my thought on it is, yeah, that is a piece of this. We need to become a better educated, more critically thinking society about how we operate in cyberspace, because when the internet was built, it was built on the assumption that it would be for communications between federally government clear, U.S. government cleared individuals on U.S. government badged and locked down bases communicating about classified programs. That same infrastructure became the internet that we all do our banking on now, right? So we do need all of us, it's multiple phases, multiple layers. We need to become better advised as individuals. We need to ask the companies that we do business with and that we own shares of or that we work at to do a better job. And we frankly need to ask our state, local, and federal government also to be more aware and doing a better job of investing, right? These are not wasteful, profligate expenses, but investing in security so that we can preserve our way of life. Are there other questions? Yeah, I don't know if.
Thank you, Andrew. Some thought-provoking comments here tonight. One of the subjects we're hearing a lot about, it kind of ties in with what you're describing on integrated systems, integrated information, blockchain. And be interested in any thoughts you might have on blockchain, and is that going to be a good thing as it relates to cybersecurity, or do we have the chance of, larger systems being taken down as a result?
So blockchain, for those who don't know, is kind of a public ledger, so to speak. It's a way that you verify transactions and information exchange between parties. It's held in multiple locations. If you could imagine that instead of having like a central bank ledger for your deposits and withdrawals, that document is held in the same copy in 1,000 different places. And that way, if two people fraudulently change it to make it look like you don't have your money, 998 people have a document that says you do. I mean, it's kind of the easiest way I can kind of break it down in terms I can understand blockchain, generally speaking. It's also the technology upon which the cryptocurrencies are based because it's a public ledger. And then you have an encrypted key that shows what your valuation is and how many coins or units you own. So I realize, let me say this. The potential is huge for leveraging blockchain technology for all kinds of things. And I'm not an expert in blockchain, but I can rapidly see how things like title deeds, property deeds, record keeping, if I'm a title deed company that holds records, I might be getting a little nervous. If I was a financial services company, I might be very interested in investing heavily in understanding blockchain and how to leverage it for more secure transactions for my customers. And I don't know that I'm answering your question, but I see a lot of potential upside as blockchain proliferates. And I also see, I think, as the lights get lifted on some of this activity, it also creates some challenges, right? I mean, we live in a society that embraces transparency. Other societies don't, right? And what would that mean for aggrieved minorities that are persecuted in countries that suddenly have all of their transactions disclosed to an authoritarian regime? I bring that up. It's a tough thing to think about, right? We would never do that. We're America. Again, our adversaries don't operate on that template. So transparency is good, but maybe transparency is good to an extent that it supports good human behavior. And that's just my own philosophical thought on it.
Is it right here? A quick question. You mentioned patch. A person might use a patch in their IT system to correct a problem. My understanding from my background is that IT experts say that sometimes when you go in the patch to fix A, you end up causing several problems. Hmm? Now, I understand that IT has been working on quality systems to try to get away from that, but I guess I'm concerned as well as the malicious person, the accidental thing that could occur in complex systems.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And so the reason I brought up patches is kind of the independent security research community, right? The good guy hackers that are paying attention identify an exploit or vulnerability and what that code looks like. Then they share that information with the manufacturer of the product, and the manufacturer of the product creates a patch, which is an update to the software, which then protects people using that system from that attack or that vulnerability. And I think increasingly, you bring up a really good point. Some of my colleagues at Symantec use the term zero trust, and I keep hearing that. It's a new term. We're operating in a zero trust environment. Just assume that like none of these endpoints, none of the people using your system, none of the other systems on the system can be trusted. Therefore, how do you operate in a zero trust environment? And again, I'll put it in Andrew Breen understandable terms. The way I got it was, I've been to San Francisco. I've seen the Golden Gate Bridge, right? I can envision that if painting the Golden Gate Bridge, I paint the Golden Gate Bridge, and by the time I get to the Napa side of the bridge, I suddenly have to get back and start painting the other bridge because it's already rusting. And so I'm trying to answer your question, and I realize it's a little obtuse, but the answer is we all have to heighten the pace at which we're doing the activity, and we have to kind of stop trusting that things are going to be okay without our own effort. You know what I mean? And that it is. It's like painting the Golden Gate Bridge. It might sound exhausting that we now have to be kind of always on cybersecurity alert in all of these fronts, but that's the world we live in, right? So, sorry I can't be more optimistic than that one, but that's the answer. It costs money to defend. Yeah. Yes, ma'am?
Thank you for your talk. I have a question about the people who are responsible for the defense. Do you think that our country is equipped in tech talent to do the defense that we have to do, that you're saying we should do? I'm a student at the University of Minnesota in computer science. Mm-hmm. Cybersecurity is not a graduation requirement. I'm going to go out into the workforce not right. knowing anything about cybersecurity. And I don't feel prepared to fight this war that you're talking about. Do you feel that we're prepared to fight?
That's a great question. Maybe an analogy is I graduated from high school and I did not know how to balance a checkbook. Is that an important life skill, balancing a checkbook? Should my school have taught me how to do that? Probably. It's not in the curriculum. Maybe it ought to be. So. You know, it's funny, back to Wells Fargo Northwest, I participated in this thing called Junior Achievement, and they used to ask bankers from all the banks in town to go teach at high schools about how do you balance a checkbook? What does it mean to borrow money? What does a credit card interest rate look like versus a car loan interest rate versus a mortgage? How do you invest in the stock market, and why is that different than a money market account, right? And so maybe part of that answer is non-traditional education. Right, and I know here in Minnesota, bear with me, Faisal, do you know Faisal? Does anybody know Faisal at Metro State? Yes, somebody knows Faisal at Metro State? I think it's Faisal Kaleem. But at Metro State here in, I think their campus is over St. Paul, he has developed a cyber range at the community college that is open to companies and the public and other students to go learn cyber defense skills. Is that the traditional way to learn cyber defense skills? No. But do you learn cyber defense skills? Yes. So the short answer to your question, I completely feel your pain. I have a very hard time right now in my current job, kind of looking at an education system that does not necessarily teach this as a skill unless somebody's been really interested in it for a long time. But I think that comes down to state legislatures. It comes down to the civil servants that we elect and saying, hey, this needs to become important. Yeah.
Hello. I wish I could share your confidence and optimism regarding the future, but it seems to me that many times we ignore obvious things that need to be prevented, and we can just think about building houses on floodplains when you know hurricanes will occur again and again, more frequently than once in 100 years. And not having the resources to rebuild and rebuild in better places, and trains that seem to crash because a braking system that was authorized for implementation has been delayed and delayed and delayed with loss of human life and potentially release of harmful chemicals into our environment. I just don't sense that there is a sufficient amount of responsibility by people who are dedicated to maximizing their profit to ensure the safety of our environment and for people.
Got it. I did not hear the question, but I appreciate the comments.
The question is, who was the 400-pound man on the sofa? Do you know him?
I don't. Unfortunately, I don't know the 400-pound pound man on the sofa. But thank you for your comments, sir. Is there a question that ends in a question mark?
I was a medic during the war in Vietnam, and over the years, I'll call it here a bias that I've developed, that we too often send mostly young people out to kill and be killed for not such good reasons. And I believe in strong defense without killing, which is what I hear you saying. But what I'm in, the question over here maybe kind of alluded to it. Do you have an assessment of how much is going on with people thinking and talking like you are, as opposed to they bombed us, let's go bomb the hell out of them?
That's a great question. It's a little bit, it's not quite in like this kind of cyber defense lane that I was talking about.
But
I want to answer it.
It is.
And I want to answer, because I think I hear what the thrust of your question is are there other people in the space, in this kind of high tech space, that think about national security, who also kind of share my belief that we want to mitigate damage as best as possible? And I'm going to give you the short answer is yes, lots, most. The vast majority, I think, would agree with me that we always want to mitigate any need for the use of violence in pursuit of national goals or in pursuit of national defense, right? And I think that is, institutionally, that's a long-held, long-standing belief, right, that America wants to be the peacemakers, right? That America wants to, really does, and I'll use that term, shining city on the hill. It makes it hard sometimes, because our adversaries don't have that same respect for life. They don't often have that same respect for the lives of their very own people. How many of you saw that Chernobyl series? Okay, so true story. I learned this through somebody in the robotics industry here in Minnesota who did some work on a crane that is actually, they built and designed this crane that is cleaning up Chernobyl from a company here in Minnesota called PAR Systems. Amazing, true story. It's a massive industrial scale crane that operates in a highly radioactive environment, saves lives. True story was that after the Chernobyl attack, what the Russians did is they mandated civilian workers who were not in the military, not that it would matter one way or the other, to go manually clear radioactive waste off the roof of the building, exposing them to a lifetime of radiation in shifts with a little radiometer. So they would put you on the roof. Here's your lifetime of radioactive exposure. You'll probably die in 4 or 5 years. Thank you for your service, right? And I bring that up because I don't think that's how we approach problems in America. I really don't. I have yet to hear that story where there was a compulsory draft where we sent young Americans to clean up radiological waste with a lifetime of exposure. We can do better than that. I know that my colleagues on, and for me personally, I have my own kind of political affiliation. I've worked on campaigns. You can see what it is. It's irrelevant on this front. We all, the vast majority of us, believe in the sanctity of human life. We believe that we want to be the good guys. How are you the good guys in this domain? Is you minimize casualties, you focus on defense, you focus on preserving life, not taking life. And so I really want to answer your question with some conviction, because it's probably the most important question that I personally heard all night. And my answer for you is a resounding yes. Those of us that work in these spheres care very much about mitigating human loss.
Where do you look to find, you know, if you're not a professional in this area, you just care, where do you look to find that happening? Do you need to read about it? Or?
I see it all over the place. Why are we proliferating the use of police body cameras in America? I mean, I'm sorry, I'm kind of drifting way off topic, but maybe I'm looking through the different lens, but I see a lot of reasons time after time where Americans and American communities do lean toward better civil order, preservation of individual rights, transparency for good reasons as opposed to transparency to uncover minorities that would be oppressed. Leveraging technologies to promote human freedom rather than leveraging technologies to either censor populations or support invidious discrimination, right? And so I think this is a personal issue for me. I joined the Marine Corps as an officer. right? I raised my hand and I signed up. I served at the Pentagon. Many years later, I continue to serve in the private sector. I've been in and out of government for a number of years. But the reason I do all of this is that in my heart of hearts, I believe that our way of life is different and it is better than those of the adversaries I've encountered and seen in the world. So again, you've just kind of hit a thing that for me is personal. Like, again, so I apologize if I went off base there. But the colleagues that I work with and the reason I work in this field is that I know they share that conviction with me. Yeah.
You mentioned looking hard for a non-internet connected garage door opener.
I did.
Is there other technology you are actively opting out of for similar reasons?
Me personally?
That we should take note of since you're an expert.
No, and I don't know. I'm also a deacon at church, and I'm told that the guy in the dress is the one that you're not supposed to listen to. So you're in heightened scrutiny. So please don't perceive that I'm an expert in personal internet safety. That's the next step of my remarks. If you're the teacher, you're scrutinized more scrutiny. No, I just personally don't like the idea of my garage door opener being on the internet. I have no real need for that. And I didn't want it. I also don't want my kitchen sink connected to the internet. Seriously, that's a thing. I don't need my toilet flush connected to the internet. I don't know, me personally, I don't wear a smartwatch because I find it annoying. The people I sit with that can't stop looking at their watch and reading email rather than looking at the time, I just find it kind of distracting. So sorry I can't give you more insight, but I don't know why I need a big company to know when I open and close my garage.
Yeah, you haven't touched about election security, and the elections are coming less than 2 years from now. Are we ready now, and are we going to be ready?
Yeah, unfortunately, you have moved into a realm in which I am not in any way, shape, or form what I would purport to be an expert on election security. That's a really hard issue for a number of reasons. I can help you understand why it's really hard, and it's hard to find experts on it. Because here in America, we have a federated election system. And so each state sets their own election policy, their own election verification methods. It reports up through the state. In fact, Mark Ritchie once had that job as the Secretary of State of Minnesota, right? So the federal government couldn't even make a federal mandated law anyway on how to do it. I do see some cause for hope. I know there have been some issues, some recent conferences where the U.S. Department of Defense, U.S. Department of Homeland Security, and U.S. intelligence agencies invited all of the various secretaries of state and election security officials to a working group. I think they did two of them already, if I'm not wrong, in the Washington, D.C. area to have that conversation. Election security is a bit of a mess, kind of like critical infrastructure, and that here in America, because we have a different system, right, we need to have stronger collaboration across some of those perceived silos. Right, so you have to have state officials working with federal officials, working with the private sector, and then auditing it. It's a very hard one to say that any one person is an expert. And an expert in Californian election security might not be an expert in New Hampshire election security, might not be an expert in Minnesota election security. So that one's going to have to be a big team effort, big team pull. And that's just on the ballot counting. The other aspects of election security that cause me concern, back to critical infrastructure, an area where I kind of do know some things, what if an adversary or a malign foreign actor or a malign domestic actor shut down the power in a number of Pennsylvania voting precincts in the last 2 hours of the election cycle? What if that same person shut down the power in other swing states, in swing districts, that targeted one partisan group over another? I mean, it's not hard to see the U.S. electoral map. You can look up gerrymandering things, and you can see, oh, well, that's the Republican district, and that's the Democrat district. And what if somebody decided to shut down one or the other of those power grids that afternoon? What would that impact be? What would that mean for a recount? I said, as an individual American that is very concerned about the future of my country, I want my federal government awake and alert to this. I want my state civil servants awake and alert to this. And I want them working together on a very regular basis between now and November 2020 for that national election, and certainly for all those other little ones in between, but especially that national one where you watch the electoral map thing flip across the whole country, because I'd like to preserve the trust in our system of government. And I think the only way we do that is if we all do believe in a free and fair election system where our votes are counted and there is no malign influence, whether it's foreign or domestic. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's a really hard issue, and I can't speak to readiness. I can just speak to what the challenges are and what I see as some areas where there is real progress.
Right here?
Oh, yeah.
Thank you. I have a question about this target hardening and the critical infrastructure and so forth. If you want a FEMA grant for mitigation, hazard mitigation, you have to write an application and the county gets it, and each city has to have its own plan and so forth. As a kind of a hobby of mine, I do hazardous freight rail watching.
That's quite a hobby.
Yeah, that's a hobby. And I've been, as a hobby, reading hazard mitigation plans where you have to go through an exercise to identify hazards. And I mapped out the places that have Bakken crude oil trains and so forth, and I looked to see if that was identified as a hazard. And, you know, in one or two places it kind of was, and my own little beautiful city of Robbinsdale has a plan to talk with BNSF, you know. But I didn't see, when I read any of them, hardly any mentions of cybersecurity. And, you know, it's sort of like that's the same kind of elephant in the room as an oil train is. And by the way, they did reroute them during the Super Bowl, but the rest of the time we're on our own. But what if you, I don't think you can reroute cybersecurity, and I'm just wondering, is FEMA and Homeland Security asking recipients of these grants if this is a checklist thing or what kind of priority it's getting?
Great question. Definitely not an area that I know. Sorry. So I apologize. But I'm not really well versed in how the FEMA grant process works. So.
Andrew, thank you very much. This has been an excellent discussion. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more to the attribution problem of cyber attacks.
The which problem?
The attribution problem.
Yeah.
So specifically that, you know, these attacks are designed so that way you don't know who actually committed them. And maybe if you could discuss a little bit about, is it possible, or to what extent is it possible, that a nation could mask who is actually making that attack, essentially conduct like a false flag operation to make it look like someone else conducted it?
Yeah, I mean, great question. Attribution is, it's not only an issue in the cyber domain. We're looking at an attribution issue right now in the news related to the attack on some oil tankers in the Persian Gulf, right? Who did it, who didn't, who's denying it? What I will say on attribution in either domain is there's an expression in law enforcement that some FBI people told me once, crime only takes a minute, but forensics is forever. Right? And so, yes, attribution is hard, but forensics is forever. And that record doesn't go away. And those investigations can go on. So I'm not saying that attribution can be done in a foolproof way, but obviously the more time and the more forensic resource that is invested into that investigation using all sources of data, the higher the percentage confidence that a policymaker can have in the attribution decision, right? I mean, just like detective work for the police. They build their case, they get it ready for trial, and the jury decides, or in some cases in America, the judge decides at a bench trial. So I would argue, yes, it is a problem, and we should all remember that forensics is forever. It's also is good advice for our children. You know, I've got 13 and 15-year-olds, back to the individual's behavior on the internet piece. I try to remind them that, you know, those things that you posted on that working document for your class, that can get you kicked out of Harvard before you even got there. You know, that just happened this week, actually. I don't know if I saw that. But yeah, so the record doesn't go away. It might be a hard chain to piece together. For kind of general awareness, too, attribution is another issue because a lot of the firms that do the research are very remiss about making attribution statements for good reason. or even if you were an independent researcher, if you made an attribution decision and attributed it to evil or scary dictator or crazy dictator, whoever, that crazy dictator might reach out and touch you. So you might be hesitant to attribute to certain parties if you did not have the power of anonymity in your attribution report, right? That's a policy consideration I think a lot of Americans probably unaware of. But that is a consideration for researchers on the internet. It's been a consideration for researchers of terrorism, right? If you're a researcher on terrorist groups, even if you're not affiliated with any government, would be to your benefit to have some protections for your anonymity, wouldn't it? So back to the transparency thing. Is total transparency really where we want to go? Or is there some mechanism by which we can preserve privacy, needed secrecy for the good guys, and some more openness for those areas where it's useful? Yeah.
My question is, could you speak a little bit more to the threat of artificial intelligence?
The threat of artificial intelligence?
I mean, it's kind of exponential in what can happen with that technology. I mean, what was said earlier about the way that we interact with social media, a lot of that was based off of artificial intelligence. Learning the way that we interact with it really like shaped the way that we see political parties and even products that companies are using. So do you think that artificial intelligence is a threat that can be used by hacktivists or other countries around the world?
It's a good question. I think the kind of two things I would answer that with. One, the word artificial intelligence is a little bit like the word robot. It means so many different things at so many different levels, right? If you look at the federal government, I think there's actually only one statutory definition of artificial intelligence, and there's kind of five subcomponents, if I'm not mistaken. And the subcomponents are things like machine learning and deep learning and I don't even know if automation qualifies as artificial intelligence. And I apologize, I did not read that statute. But AI is not like Commander Data from Star Trek right now. That is not where we are on the maturity model of artificial intelligence. AI is also more sophisticated than AlphaGo, which, for those that don't know, Go is like an Asian version of chess that has considerably more permutations, but it's a finite structure, and they made a computer model, and it beat the best human player of Go, just like what Deep Blue beat Garry Kasparov after it was built by IBM. So somewhere in the middle is where the reality of artificial intelligence capability lives. Right? And a lot of what we see that we call artificial intelligence is actually a bunch of other things. Natural language processing, speech recognition, a battery of responses that you say a thing, it converts what you said in natural language processing into computer language, then sends it through the cloud, and then Siri comes back to you and says a phrase, not because Siri is an artificial intelligent sentient being who's interacting with you, but it went, you know, there's a million things you can say, there's a million things Siri can say, rack and stack and spit it out, and it's really just an automated process, right? So to that point, yes, I guess you could convert that to nefarious ends. I'm not sure what it would be off the top of my head. Maybe I'm not as creative as that. I think what I would be more concerned about is, and back to us, how are we gonna be the good guys as these things are developed? So would it be ethical or considered in line with our values to develop AI algorithms that would identify behaviors that would identify someone's sexual persuasion in countries or regimes where those people are targeted for prosecution or worse? Would we support that because it's just technology? Would we want to think about the security of those algorithms and that computer code before we start creating it if that capability is a potential outcome? Now I want to get into the other, to your point, sir, you don't have to respond with cyber to cyber, right? So could we also do other things like put export controls on those technologies? So if a technology that has lots of beneficial use could also be used for malign purposes, for invidious discrimination, for targeting and harming minorities in other places, could we use our foreign law enforcement mechanisms on things like export controls? Could we put some of these things into the dual use category? Maybe not because they're dual use for military technology, but because they're dual use for oppression or censorship. And again, that's kind of my own out of the box thought, right? But I know that there's some kind of, there are discussions that there's this thing coming and AI is gonna come take us all over and then we're gonna work for our robot overlords. I wanna say on the record right now, I for one welcome our robot overlords. So when that video runs through the big giant brain, I welcomed them, okay? I'm good.
Well, sorry. Thank you. Thank you very much, Andrew Boreen. Join me in thanking him again.
Thank you.
I think Andrew's going to be here for a little bit for see a few more questions, but I want to remind you that this videotape will be up not just for the robot warlord or overlord, as he called him, but for others' purposes. And again, if you'd like to join and become part of the Global Minnesota team and process, please see us outside the back. And please keep Global Minnesota in mind when you're thinking of ideas and questions and things that we as a public need to be educating ourselves and our friends about. We'll be doing a lot more programs, bring your friends, but also bring your ideas, your passions, and the way that you see the future. And again, join me in thanking again our Minnesotan, Andrew Boreen.
That's right. Thank you.